The National Broadcasting Company presents Analog.
My name is Valerie Russell, and I come originally from Boston, Massachusetts, and I am now working in communications for the National Student YWCA here in New York City.
I'm Defane Tabor. I come originally from Midland, Texas, which is in the western part of the state, and I work in the Membership Development Unit of the Girl Scouts of USA.
I was going to ask you, I think most of us, especially those people who are listening that come from suburban communities, do have a lot of contact with the Girl Scouts and through Brownie Troops. And I remember myself that when I was in the fourth grade, is it that you fly up? It was
yes.
One of the, you know, really exciting times. But what really led you to work for the Girl Scouts? And, you know, where are the Girl Scouts going in terms of their program? What do they see as basically essential?
Let me answer the first part of your question first, Valerie. I was in a troop in Texas, and I live two blocks from the railroad track, and my stepfather is an automobile mechanic. There are four daughters in the family, and obviously we didn't have much.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we knew we didn't have much, but it didn't make too much difference because a lot of the other people that we associated with and lived close to were about in the same state that we were. So it's not until I've gotten grown that I realized just how poor we were.
Yeah.
But the fact remains that no matter what my father's occupation, no matter what church I belonged to, or no matter what our bank account was, I could still belong to the Girl Scouts. And I can truthfully say I learned about as much in the Girl Scout program of practical use as I learned in my school years. Now, that's saying a lot, but today I find that attitudes and skills and whetting of the curiosity and awareness came not from the classroom situation, mm-hmm. but from social contacts and from belonging to a troop myself. I grew up and consequently led a troop because I'm a teacher by profession. And as I was teaching, my volunteer job was in both, I had a Tri-High Y group and a senior scout troop. So a lot of my adult education or continuing education came, I think, through volunteer agencies in the community. And I could talk for a long, long time on where I think the Girl Scouts are going. I've been in both as a girl and as an adult and now as a professional worker.
Mm-hmm.
For almost 25 years, and that sounds like an eternity.
That's a really long time to commit yourself to one place, I know.
Were you a participant of the Y program as a child yourself?
No, it's actually amazing about me. I grew up much more closely related to church movements, to youth fellowships, and I still have some involvement. I just got back last week from Detroit from the National Council of Churches meetings, which you probably all heard about. Where some exciting things happened. But I went to college in a very roundabout way. It took me 7 years to get through undergraduate school because I began going to the University of Massachusetts and then dropped out and worked for a while for the Boston City Missionary Society, which is an organization that tries to find social outreach through the churches. And then I went back to school to a small college, commuter college, Suffolk University in Boston, and really became academically turned on to sociology, and at the same time was able to get involved in a place called the Blue Hill Center, which was in Roxbury, in the ghetto area of Roxbury. Having grown up in a middle-class community and being a black person, it was very important for me to be able to participate in the city and to come to a new level of black consciousness, which I spent a lot of time doing, and all of us spent a lot of time doing. This was during the early days of the freedom movement, so I had a really exciting and dynamic time there working with a group of teenagers in a freedom choir, and we used to travel around to suburban groups talking about the problems in the city, schools, housing, police, you know, the whole gamut of the kinds of urban problems that we hear now.
Well, our backgrounds, although separated by hundreds, thousands of miles geographically, sound quite a bit alike. I, too, was very active in the church, in the training program, in the Baptist church, and I attribute a lot of my attitudes and values, of course, to that training. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it was not through the church or the school that I got what I call my racial consciousness. It was through scouting.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
At that time in Texas, people lived apart. There was a Mexican-American side of town, mm-hmm. a black side of town, and poor whites, and then, you know, the affluent or middle-upper and upper-class whites. And so it was an economic barrier as well as a racial barrier. But kids sometimes don't make as much, or they're not as conscious of differences, or they're intrigued by momentarily, and then they just become good buddies. And
our
parents obviously pass on a lot of unknown prejudices. And in our scout troop, one of the girls named Geraldine brought in a girl named Irma Linda Rodriguez. Well, this was something new and different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were Catholics, Protestants, and Jews within the troop that I belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
But Irma Linda brought in another element that was fascinating, and it was in through Girl Scout camping that I made friends from the black community, and some of those are still my friends from, you know, when I was, say, 12 and 13, which to me is a pretty lasting friendship since I'm over 30 now.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I've just got mm-hmm. so many opportunities that I was unaware of the full implications of it as a child, that after I had taught school a while in Texas, I was offered a job with the Girl Scouts, and I was primarily interested in some kind of youth work. I decided to give it a try and have gone from the local council to the national staff. I guess because, Valerie, I have a feeling that I got so much out of it as a child, and I was mm-hmm. unaware of the
so
volunteerism
really
that went into it, and I was unaware of the public funding that had to go into keeping a scout council going, both the recruitment and the training of adults, and all the things that have to go into making a community agency move and go and grow. I feel like that it's my role in life to pay back, in a way. Not solely pay back that indebtedness, but that's what society is all about, that we have to keep on offering more opportunities to people, and some of us have to give. And
mm-hmm.
I chose to work for a nonprofit organization because of this commitment rather than for a profit incentive
mm-hmm.
corporation or something.
I think this is one of the most exciting things that's happening for me personally in society right now. And it is a kind of a whole reevaluation of the voluntary agency in terms of trying to meet the problems of social change.
Oh, there's so many exciting things going on.
There really are.
Every level.
And the reason, you know, that I got related to this was that I began working with college students while I was in college. That's when I first came into an awareness of the kinds of contacts that I could make through a national student movement. That's where I've decided to work. Because I think that certainly a lot of ferment is happening right now of any place inside the college campuses. Many of our students are really wrestling, you know, with the whole issues of black empowerment, the elimination of poverty. They're seeking to find new ways of participation inside the society, the 18-year-old mm-hmm. vote. They're concerned about abortion. And it's a very dynamic place, you know, for me to be right now, because through my experiences in Roxbury and through seeing historically what's happened to the freedom movement as it's developed right now in the country, I think that what we need more than anything else is to build bridges mm-hmm. between experiences and across gaps. You know, and it's interesting, like, that you and I come from, as you say, similar backgrounds in a way, but very different kinds of cultural
yes.
contexts. And yet, you know, both of us can choose to somehow work out our commitments in a service kind of an agency, which is trying very hard to come to grips with some of the issues of the day. And one of the reasons that I've chosen to work for the YWCA is that I appreciate being young, having the power to work in a national agency and to make decisions and to influence
programs.
Don't you
think, Valerie, a lot of people don't consider when they look at their lives and they think, I want to make a difference. I want to be involved. I want my life to count and my influence to count and to help move things, to change things. Don't you think a lot of people today discredit or disqualify from their thinking the established agencies in the country, like the Y, the Girl Scouts, any church-related group or Salvation Army? And unfortunately, they're the places that I think so many opportunities are happening. If nothing else, they provide an excuse for one-to-one contact.
And
a beginning place.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are lots of reasons for this. I think, number one, a lot of voluntary agencies in the past, and I include the church in this, have felt relatively powerless in relationship to, you know, the bigness and the complexities of the industrial and the technological society.
Almost separated from it, knowing that we're in society together, but
we're in
a little...
But I think they felt basically powerless.
Right, in a little spot over here by ourselves, and we don't really affect or influence the rest of it.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem was also reinforced by the fact that these groups tended to respond in traditional ways. You know, I have a friend who told me a great story that I always like to tell, that she was being courted by a soldier, an army captain, and he showed up, you know, in his full array and everything. And she was very impressed. And they went to this movie, and she was very nervous. And as they walked down the aisle and she went to turn into her seat, she genuflected. And I always thought that, you know, genuflecting in the movie theater was, you know, an inappropriate response for that situation. And I think that traditionally, you know, a lot of our service agencies have been caught genuflecting in the movie theater. And that it is not until recently, and I think it's like with the coming of the civil rights movement, and I think women's liberation, I'd like to talk about that in a moment, which affects the Girl Scouts and the YWCA as traditional organizations, has brought a new sense of power and a feeling that, you know, we have to revamp our structures, we have to renew our directions, and we have to learn how to stop genuflecting in the movie theater, right, and find whole new methods by which we can relate to the kinds of issues that I said before. And well, I think some of our organizations are really just taking a whole hard new look at how you do that.
We have to.
And I'm excited about being involved in that.
I am too. You know? I am too. It's tough at times because I think change, first being conscious of change and communicating the need for change to other people and being convinced of it ourselves and then controlling it, because I think sometimes we just think that everything's changing so fast that we have no control whatsoever on our environment or the military-industrial complex or anything.
Well,
but
I'm
not
sure you can control it. I think you can shape it,
well,
if that's better. Because when people say control, it's like standing over against. I think a lot of people have the feeling that we've got to slow change down, and I'm not sure that that's possible. But I think we can shape it.
Well, I suppose I'm thinking more in terms of a gushing stream or something. I think that we can center it and give direction to change and make sure that it's in the direction that we in this day and age are convinced that it should be going in towards some of the goals that we hold in common. That's more of the concept of control that I thought, rather than just having a hopeless feeling of everything being in an upheaval and nobody being able to focus it.
Well, in talking about focusing, I think that it's important to be in the kind of a situation where you meet as many kinds of different people, you know, a real heterogeneous situation. And I mentioned it a minute ago, the women's liberation movement, and I'd just like to share with you that this has given us a whole new organizational handle, because, you know, the concept of what it means to mobilize women for change in our agency has given us a handle to cut across generational gaps, to cut across racial lines, and it's been really exciting. I was sitting in a meeting yesterday of some women from, I don't know, about 7 or 8 agencies, and we were talking about what it would mean to form a political party
of just women,
of women in this society, if you could do it, and how do you begin to really shape the consciousness of women to feel that they too can participate, like in that kind of change.
I think there's a fine line probably here that we're both seeking, and as far as the organizations that we work for, both of our corporate charters say that we are non-political, non-sectarian, and not for pecuniary profit. The question is, where does social awareness and conscience stop, and where does social action begin? When do we as non-political organizations, how far do we go in working towards something, pushing mm-hmm. it? How can we sanction it as a, I mean, if we can't sanction something as a national organization and put our stamp of approval or mm-hmm. rejection on it, mm-hmm. how do we then become a social force in helping our members take up individual responsibility?
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I think, you know, there are a couple of things. Number one, you can help your members to make decisions and choices that I think we're all faced with every day. I think one of the reasons that we have such a feeling of crisis right now is because of mass media. I think it's one mm-hmm. of the reasons that we are educated, more educated as a mass than ever before. But I also think it creates the great feelings of ambivalence, because so much is always, you know, crowding through to us. Even at the younger levels, you know, Marshall McLuhan says a child goes to school and still learns about Dick and Jane and Spot.
Right, when he's already had all this.
And then comes home and watches Huntley and Brinkley and the local war that night on television, you know. And so constantly we're being bombarded by facts and cries and interest groups and dilemmas. And so that the individual has to continually make decisions
choices.
Yeah. And the second thing is that even though we may put off making choices and say that we are being non-political, I think that not to choose is to choose in some senses. This goes back to the fine line that you were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's really hard to stand someplace and not to speak out.
All right, if the Girl Scouts,
because
say, for instance,
by standing
for 57 years have been a pro conservation, take care of the land,
right.
Don't waste water and timber, and don't litter, and, you know, leave a campsite better than you found it. These are simple ways that children learn and develop a social consciousness of taking care of our natural resources. And yet, when it comes to saving the Grand Canyon or keeping Disneyland out of the High Sierras, it's almost has to become an individual responsibility. To write letters, to join the Sierra Club, or to support them in a fight, or that sort of thing. I don't see how we as a movement can, or say the National Board of Directors of the Girl Scouts or the Y can say, can speak for 3 million members, or 6 million
members. Well, but I think that's why we have democratic processes. Like, we are getting ready to have our convention, our triennium convention in April in 1970.
We just had one in October.
I heard a little about that.
Rather exciting.
Well, it is the time when your constituency can come together and say where they will stand and what they will stand on. I think that organizations like ours do have a responsibility to say, look at our environment, because it says something about the quality of life. And that's the business that we're in, you know, really. It's in the business of really talking and shaping the quality of life. And so, therefore, we have the responsibility of talking about population, of talking about pollution and what's happening to our natural resources. Because if we remain mute, then it seems to me we're defeating all of our purposes. And this is where I think, again, the need for integration between human development and somehow dealing with the social context of our lives is really paramount. And that volunteer agencies like ours have to continue to find a way of doing it, or else we're going to keep genuflecting in the movie theater. You know, we really are.
Right. But I do think, again, that we have to be careful about the kinds of stands we make as a movement.
No, sure.
Because the minute we take certain stands that might have a political leaning one way or the other, we automatically decrease our effectiveness or our potential reach to probably half again as many people as we've got involved.
You know, here's a question of how far you can play both ends against the middle. There are some things you have to come down quite clearly on. You know, you're either going to be in one situation on the side of justice or injustice. I mean, you have to continually, it seems to me, make those assessments. And I don't see how you can really play it both ways. And I think this is one of the dilemmas that organizations like yours and mine are really coming to face, because we're going to lose some end of the spectrum polarizing society.
One way or the other.
And so now I think the question is, we have to be intentional about which side we're going to risk losing, which means that we have to be intentional about where we stand. I think there's a difference between politically lobbying with a congressman as an organization for a particular bill and standing up and raising the moral and very intricate questions about justice.
Well, Girl Scouts, I suppose, if you want to call it that, we made a stand. One of our objectives of the national movement is that our membership is truly representative of the population of the country. We also have said that we support the findings of the Kerner Commission report, and our councils, some almost 400 councils across the country, have said, yes, we too believe in a single society, a true union, and are willing to work toward those ends. Now, in some parts of this country, you know that that very stand was, dangerous to some, because it meant losing some of their members and maybe even some of their financial support from the community.
But you've got to make those kinds of stance, or else you become a wishy-washy.
Right. Yeah. During the last 3 years, we have, because of a deep desire to reach all girls, we've organized about 3,500 troops in least well-served, hard-to-reach, disadvantaged, I don't care what you call them, areas, both rural and urban, in the country. And to me, this is moving to where we ought to be. We still haven't done enough. We have not done all we could do or should do. And I'll be the first to admit that. But at least I'm excited, because I think the 650,000 volunteers in our movement are aware, and some of them are willing and able. Some are fearful. They're not sure how to move, and they're afraid of making mistakes and making matters worse than they were. But again, I feel a sense of urgency, of excitement, of caring about a lot of things. And I think the time's right for people to make a stand, either as an individual or as a group, if we can.
Because I don't want to keep harping on this, but I think we are on an important point. Because it seems to me that, again, we go back to power, in terms of talking about power, that unless somehow we can see a way of making our own agencies instruments of power, you know, in terms of shaping lifestyle and choices, then it seems to me we weaken ourselves in terms of any kind of impact, you know, that we can either have in society or that we can really make professionally, you know, in terms of the kinds of concerns that each of us have. So, I don't know. It's a very difficult situation, and I think a lot of people are fearful, partially because we haven't really ever been where we are today.
True.
A lot of my black friends are very despondent and really believe that it's kind of inherent in man's nature that we react out of fear, and that we are violent, and that we are very class conscious. And I say, well, historically, you know, that's been true. But we have never before been in a society at a time like this when it was technologically possible, for example, for us to produce enough so that no man had to go hungry. If we can redefine, you see, the way that we distribute wealth or goods.
Right, our services.
Or services. I mean, you know, that's whole part of a package. And therefore, maybe it's not so necessary anymore that I have to stand on someone else's back or else I starve. But these are whole new definitions, you know, that we have to work out in our society that historically no society has ever before had to face. And I think that's part of the reason why there's so much fear. It's part of the reason that people search for different models. You know, there's a lot of fear still about whether the communistic model, the socialistic model for society is the best. And I say that we don't have a model for this society which is the best, and that it's people like myself and yourself in our academic pursuits and in our professional lives to build a new kind of a model, because we've never lived in such a time of technological advance before.
Well, that's why dreaming is
beyond, you know, even perception about what life will look like in the year 2000.
I'm smiling, Valerie, because you use the word model, and I look back and a lady named Ms. Johnson, who was just a plain vanilla kind of lady, you know, she would say, "I'm just a housewife." You know, if she were asked what her profession was, "I'm just a housewife." She was my troop leader as a child, and I credit her with much influence on my life. The decision to try to go to college, to try to make something of myself and be a contributing member of society. She was my model.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, if on a one-to-one basis I can inspire some woman to take a scout troop, a tri-high-y group, work in, you know, here I sound like I'm working for all agencies. I really am. I am a member of the Girl Scout staff, but I believe that there's room for all,
right,
and we all should be
working together.
But if I can inspire adults, young adults, young men even, to work with Girl Scout troops and be that role model, provide that role model, so that kids can try on different roles and finally evolve who they are and what their role in life is, then I feel like that, you know, I've done part of what I'm here to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, the role that I play in a multiracial institution right now is a very interesting one, especially in light of the kinds of concerns that you hear rising up amongst black students on campus. You know, the whole cry for black studies and the whole struggle that, you know, black people are trying to find their identity and to demand a rightful place in terms of black empowerment. And it seems to me that my role is to help, you know, black students to find that kind of black identity, but also to try to force them to the point of where they are impeccably sure about their strategies so that they are not put in the position of reacting, you know, rather than acting. And to do this the same way in terms of the white community when the confrontation happens. See, I think part of what's happening, you know, right now is that confrontation is necessary. You know, it's always been part of change.
Yes, and somehow confrontation in the past has had a sort of a negative aspect.
That's right.
And I think now it's becoming more positive. We know that we can confront one another, either as individuals or in groups, and get down to some of the basic things that are keeping us apart.
Right. If we realize that the first kind of response we're apt to have is one of reaction, you know.
Yes, overreaction.
And if we can, overreaction, right. And if we can work through overreaction to a point of action where we can respect each other from the integrity of our own stances, then it seems to me that we can work together.
You have been listening to Analog, a radio series we present in cooperation with the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Our guests today were Miss Valerie Russell of the Young Women's Christian Association and Miss Defane Tabor of the Girl Scouts of the USA. On each of these analog broadcasts, we've asked the participants to share something with us that has guided them and might be considered food for thought. Today, Valerie Russell quoted Robert Kennedy's quote of George Bernard Shaw, "Some people see things as they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not." And Defane Tabor cited Maria von Trapp's words, "A bell is no bell till you ring it. A song is no song till you sing it. And love in your heart wasn't put there to stay. Love isn't love till you give it away." Gene Hamilton speaking. This recorded program, produced by Rhoda Grady and directed by Jeffrey Culliver, has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.